Marshall and Sagar here. Welcome back to The Realignment.
Radio has the best pictures. You know, it's a beautiful medium. It's an evocative medium. It's an easier medium, clearly, obviously, to produce than television, cheaper. And you can do great stuff. And back to the whole community thing. That's why you have a listenership. People like to hear, to be part of a community. And it's easier to invite people into that community than when it's got to be a slickly produced television show.
Anyone who works with Sagar and I knows that booking for this show is not exactly the most precise or the best planned out feature. However, there has been one booking which has been on our calendar ever since last December. It's for Lisa Napoli, our guest today. We brought her on to talk about her book Up All Night, Ted Turner, CNN, and the birth of 24-hour news. We were talking about the media, how cable worked, innovation in the space, what that meant for America after the Trump presidency when there's going to be this decline in news viewership. It was an amazing episode, and I said this at the start of the show, but something people appreciated was the fact that we were talking about how an industry worked and what it meant for people. And that was huge for Sagar and I, because we don't want to just be a show that's going to just give our opinions and have people slinging takes. There's not that much value in it. So everything that Lisa does, including in her book that we're here to talk about today, Susan, Linda, Nina, and Koki, The Extraordinary Story of the Founding Mothers of NPR, really focuses on that.
Love this interview with Lisa. Lisa is really like us in that she has to understand history before she can even begin to understand and discuss present day. So you're listening to this most likely. I'm in your earphones or I'm on your speaker. And this is a very interesting medium to the way that has almost come full circle of the visceral connection that we feel with our audio products that we feel like inform us. And that was born in many ways by NPR. This is both a history of NPR, but it's a story of news and communication itself through the audio format. And what we love about Lisa's work is Lisa had wrote that book on Ted Turner, on CNN. She was also literally there in the newsroom at the New York Times in the early 90s, one of the first dot-com reporters. She both lived it, so she understands the industry and where it came from, lived it, and can tell us where we think things are going today. Also, personally, favorite part is at the very end, where we were just talking about books and great biographies for the last like 10 minutes. And that is an excellent segue to please make sure you check out our bookshop, which is in the show notes, where you can buy Lisa's book, her previous one, any of the ones that she recommends, any of the stuff that Marshall and I have been recommending recently. It's a great way to help out an independent bookstore during the pandemic depression, and it helps support our work here. Once again, go ahead and check those out.
And a note for all you listeners that demand longer content. This is our second episode in a row that we've gone over an hour. So we expect you all to be there in the YouTube comments, to be there on the Apple Podcast reviewers. Every single one of you who gave us 4, 3, 2, even 1 stars because you're mad at us for only taking 45 minutes of people's times. We expect you to come rearing back to us with encouragement over the fact that we're doing slightly longer content. Also, before we get to questions, yes, we've been getting your tweets, your Instagrams, your emails. We are very well aware of the fact that the Realignment's theme song has recently been a part of a nationwide Hooters campaign. Thank you for sending it to us. We'll actually put a link in the newsletter that goes out on Thursday. It was horrible. It isn't even a good ad. That's the weird part. You know our thing. It's jaunty. It's fun. I sort of see us walking up a street in Madison Avenue, suits on. But they're doing it during a Hooters ad. It did not look good, and I'm really disappointed in you Hooters. I like to imagine that there is a mid-level marketing person at Hooters who loves the realignment and picked it as a theme song. Not great job.
Wait, so you're telling me that Hooters put out a subpar, trashy product based upon something which is elegant, refined, and actually decent. I couldn't imagine such a world where that would happen. Okay, let's get with the question and answer period.
Today's question comes via email, so name is redacted for now. Quick reminder, you can get a question to the realignment by leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, sending us a screenshot, or emailing us at realignmentpod@gmail.com. Today's question is, you guys podcast, this is what you do. Are there any non-political podcasts that you would recommend we listen to?
Okay, I'm a huge history podcast guy, but and if I could offer literally just one recommendation, it is called The Explorers Podcast. I'm completely obsessed with this guy. He has done such incredible series on explorers from Apollo 11 to Bartolomeo Diaz, who I'm sure some of you may not even know, Henry the Navigator. My favorite series that he's done is Ferdinand Magellan, the first circumnavigation of the world, Sir Francis Drake, and how he was basically like this pirate who also circumnavigated the world. There's so much to be learned there. I was drawn to it from his Conquistador series in terms of the fall of the Aztec Empire and Hernan Cortez, but can't recommend it enough. And he's got an upcoming one on Sir Ernest Shackleton. So if you guys have followed me or you saw me on Lex Friedman's podcast, I'm completely obsessed with. I cannot wait to listen to that. And I totally recommend his podcast. What about you, Marshall?
I'm going to do the exact opposite of what you just did, Sucker. You gave us a niche, interesting, hadn't heard of podcast that needs a lot of help. Instead, I'm just going to say, listen to The Rewatchables, which is
it's great.
The Ringer. Yeah. It's at Spotify. They literally do not need any of y'all's help, but it's been such a fun thing to listen to over the past year. It's hard to find a podcast that you can work to because you're either paying too much attention or it just serves as a bit of a distraction. So The Rewatchables is great because I love their episodes, especially after watching a movie. Gone Girl, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, Mean Girls, hitting three different decades there. It's been my absolute favorite, and it's what I love listening to when I don't want to think about the news or politics or anything like that.
Great recommendation. I love some of the Ringer stuff. Back when Westworld was a thing and actually a decent show, I used to listen to their recap of Westworld theories like every single time. With that, as always, a special thank you to the Lincoln Network for sponsoring this podcast. We really appreciate the work that they let us do. Let's dive in.
Lisa Napoli, welcome back to The Realignment.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited.
Good to see you, Lisa.
Ditto.
So this episode is going to do a couple of things. One, it's going to indulge in Sagar and my deep interest in the history of NPR, which may seem random, but if there is one thing that definitely brings back 1990s memories, it's just getting exposed to NPR, listening on the radio when our parents were driving us to school. The whole reason why I'm interested in politics and news and everything was definitely the fact that I spent probably untold amounts of time with the voices you're really talking about. So I think this is really interesting.
Cool. That's great. That's great. You're my audience, so I'm glad to hear you say that.
We love it.
Yeah, so we were explaining this a bit before the show, but the reason why we wanted to bring you back, and I also want to pay you one final last like rev you up compliment. When we brought you on to talk about Ted Turner and CNN, that was a bit of a random choice. We just loved the book and said, hey, it's December. It's not quite in the deep politics every day, but let's just talk about something. But we got amazing feedback on the episode. And someone specifically said, I didn't think I was going to be interested in this topic, but I came away from this just understanding how the news industry and technology and media worked. So that's what we want to really get to, because that provided us a bit of an impetus for using this as a way of talking about a media industry that's definitely upended during COVID, even before COVID, to tie this into the past and then look into the future.
I'm so happy to hear you say that. And whoever said that, I love them, because, you know, it so amazes me that people don't think that history is a natural starting point in understanding where we are today. I spent the last year, when I wasn't writing this book, immersed in pandemic history because I was so curious about how we dealt with things before. And so understanding where we are now, it just seems like such a duh natural to me. And clearly you have very intelligent listeners who understand that, you know, to get where we are today, to understand where we are today, we have to understand how we got here. And none of this stuff was stuff I've known, and I've pretty much lived much of it. So that's the other reason too. It's not just people who are younger, but people who have lived it themselves in those places. So many people said to me about the CNN book, I didn't know any of that. And some of them spent decades there. So that's a big compliment when you hole up and do the thankless, crazy work of writing a book. So thanks again.
Lisa, one thing I want to get from you on this, first of all, is why you decided to write the book this way, specifically with the characters, but also give us a general purpose history of NPR and tie it to where we are today. Because it's kind of crazy when you're reading it to think about how we're coming full circle in terms of audio. The vast majority of the people listening to this are just listening to my voice. Audio has become an explosion. I remember when I first discovered that people were watching podcasts. I was like, what are you talking about? So people like watch people talk, and we have thousands of people who do that here too, which is all good. I totally understand it now. I actually even do it myself sometimes, and I understand people switch back and forth. So take us through that, both in terms of why I decided to write the book, the history of audio as this format, NPR specifically, and then tie it a little bit today.
Okay, and I've got 2 minutes, right?
You have got all the time you need.
Thanks. I'll braid the answers to those two questions together. It's so incredible to think that in the 1960s and 70s, radio was the hidden medium, especially educational media, which became public broadcasting. As television dawned, radio got kind of shunted to the side. And, you know, you listen to it in the car. You might listen to it while you were making dinner in the kitchen, listen to AM radio. You'd maybe have a news break. But once television came on the scene and big-footed radio out of the picture as an entertainment, you know, family sitting around the living room listening to it kind of thing, radio was kind of left for dead. Like we talked last time about how UHF was the lunatic fringe of broadcasting back in the 70s, radio was eh. And what happened for me was I finished writing that CNN book, and I said to my editor, I'm going to go to graduate school to study biography. And he's like, he didn't say you're old, but he said, why would you do that? And you're writing these books. And he said, because I love biography and I want to have the degree and I want to understand it from a different point of view. And a couple of days later, he called me, and Cokie Roberts had just died. And he said, well, you want to write biography. How about you write a biography of Cokie Roberts? Because he saw the, you know, outrageous grief and sympathy for this woman. Many people didn't know. They felt such ownership of her. And I thought about it. And I knew Cokie Roberts was Cokie Roberts, but I didn't really understand her history. I'm not a big political junkie. So I wasn't one of those morning show diehards who would have seen her for years, but I knew she was huge. And I knew it was tragically sad that at 75, she died of cancer, which she thought she'd beat. And I thought about it. I talked with a couple of people about it. And they said, the founding mothers of NPR is a really interesting story. And digging a little bit deeper, I realized, wow, the founding NPR was chartered in 1970. This year, May 3rd, to be specific, is the 50th anniversary of the first news broadcast from NPR. So ding, 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 peg. I called up the editor and I said, I like the Cokie idea, but it just feels better for me, especially having just written that book about the birth of CNN. Let's look at the birth of NPR. And so in sort of a roundabout way to answer your question, I start thinking, okay, Susan Stamberg, Linda Wertheimer, Nina Totenberg, and Cokie Roberts were this, quartet of people. Actually, the three latter women were really, really close friends. Susan was slightly older, and slightly apart from them, different kind of ethos, more about that in a minute. But nonetheless, they called themselves the founding mothers of NPR. And as I was researching their respective histories set against the backdrop of the creation of NPR, because Susan and Linda showed up in 71, Nina showed up in 74, Cokie came in 78. So literally that whole first 10 years of NPR they were hugely instrumental in getting it out there on the map at, being the public voice. But what also occurred to me was that this is when the women's movement was exploding. So not only were they instrumental to the creation of NPR and establishing it as a force that became what it is today, they were busting down barriers that women had met in the news business for years, because people had a token woman in a newsroom, maybe, and that token woman covered maybe weather or maybe women's news. It was extremely unusual and very difficult for women to get on the air jobs or even byline jobs, even, you know, where who cares if the person is reporting, who should care about any of it? But it was really hard for women to get jobs as byline reporters anywhere. And so all of those stories twinned together, braided together, seemed natural to me. Like the last book, it just seems like, wow, I can't believe nobody's ever stitched this together before. And then, and I'll stop talking in just a second, then what happened was I realized there's no way I'm going to write a, what they call in biography, cradle to grave of NPR or of these women in a year, if I have to write it in a year to make the deadline so that it comes out for NPR's anniversary. And that's when I was sitting right before the pandemic shut everything down at the University of Maryland Hornbake Library, this amazing broadcasting research library where Susan Stamberg had left her papers, thank goodness. And there's so much material there and fabulous librarians. And there I am, it's freezing cold. I show up every day, take off my coat, sit down, they wheel out the boxes. And I'm reading about Frank Mankiewicz, the third president of NPR. And I thought, wow, this is an incredible story. And I'd be surprised how many people who work at NPR today, much less listeners, know that Frank Mankiewicz was simultaneously the man who brought NPR to even greater acclaim alongside these women, and then almost killed it. So it just seemed like a perfect gem of a story. And as you said in the beginning, or as your listener had pointed out, it really is so instructive. Everything's cyclical, politics, everything. Life is cyclical. So it's the media stories are cyclical too. And the idea that NPR had started as this sleepy kind of nobody knew if it was going to make it. These women kind of got their way, made their way in the place just because they were ambitious and they had the jobs and they were in there. And it was kind of like, oh, you want to do a story? Oh, you want to host? You want to do this? That's how it really basically worked at the very beginning. It was classic startup. And then as it graduated to the next level, it almost died. It's such a fascinating story. I hope you'll all read it.
Yeah, and let's talk about structure for a second, because we have a decent international listenership, which probably doesn't listen to NPR. Okay. So let's talk about the structure of NPR. So NPR, as I understand it, is a nonprofit corporation. So given that context, and if you're not watching the video, you're seeing me trying to wait until I get corrected for a misstatement, but as a nonprofit corporation, what does failure even look like? How can you fail when you have this national mission, you receive a degree of government support? How is it possible that a model like that could lead to failure in the 70s?
Excellent question. Well, you know, the misperception of nonprofits, and I know a fair amount, I'm certainly not an expert, but having written my Joan Kroc book and, you know, danced around the nonprofit world for so long, I'm intrigued by this belief that just because a nonprofit is nonprofit doesn't mean it has to make money or has to make an income and balance the books the way you do personally and your employers do personally. I mean, there's organizationally. So the misperception is that a nonprofit just sails along and raises money and does good and yeah, 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 there you go. I mean, just to go back to the roots of public broadcasting was established by President Johnson in the late 60s because commercial broadcasting was making a fortune and had this, as we talked about the last time, this triopoly, these three networks controlled the airwaves, both on the local and national level. And that was worrisome to people. People were worried, A, that three companies controlled public airwaves, that basically, there's that framework that was set up was to sort of offset the idea that these three networks controlled broadcasting. And the model proposed was like the BBC, and probably, I don't know much about how it's set up in other nations, but I think it's probably similar, that a government funds a media outlet, and that, you know, basically in essence controls the media outlet. But that's not what they wanted to do here in the late 60s when they were setting up public broadcasting. Basically what they were saying is, we need to set up an alternative to commercial broadcasting that doesn't just focus on the commercial interest. But that doesn't mean that it doesn't have to balance the books or raise money or get money in the tent to do the productions that it does. Now, of course, public broadcasting evolved gradually, just as, you know, every startup does. And I can talk more about that in a second, but just in answer to your question, it's the idea that a nonprofit can just, you know, do whatever it wants, and it can't. I mean, that they're always bad guys, but
So one of the things I want to get to, Lisa, and to us, I think in particular, and probably a lot of our audience, which is, it was fascinating to me to read the genesis of listener-supported media. And I think this is very important in the context of where we're at today in the Substack revolution and all of that. And I definitely want to hear your thoughts. I love the story itself of how this kind of came about. Could you tell it to the audience about how NPR got to the point of soliciting donations and receiving and creating, I think, not even really understanding at that point how much they meant to the lives of so many people who were willing to be like, take my money. I love your product. That's something that I would love to hear about.
You know, it's so scary how people are so willing to give money to something they love and not think about how it's spent, but that's a whole other conversation. but it is important to say with NPR, vis-a-vis that comment, that NPR was not set up to raise money from the public. It was, and it's still to this day confusing for even people who give lots of money, including, by the way, Joan Kroc, who gave NPR, when she died, $250 million, or what wound up being $250 million. Basically, people, when they're listening in their local markets, don't understand the difference between this little receptacle or big receptacle in whatever market I live in versus the network itself. It's not dissimilar from, I watch local ABC, W, whatever it is, to see the ABC network. And yet, you know, the local news is produced by the local station, whoever owns that. And then the national news comes from the network. That's basically how NPR and its member stations are set up. And in its very beginnings, NPR was not set up to raise money. The people who raised the money were the local stations. The finances were completely different in that the local stations today get money from their listeners. They get money from selling basically ads. They get some government money. Whatever government money there is given to the local stations more than it is to NPR, the network. Mostly that to make sure that the local stations serve the local audience. The big concern in the 60s and today too, of course, is that this hyper-local thing that we all know is important, and we've certainly lived why it's important, was starting to eradicate. And so they wanted to bolster local media. Okay, I'm getting off on too many tangents, but basically NPR, the local station, takes that money now and pays at some sort of fee that is something to do with their listenership and the market size to NPR, the network. NPR, parallel to that, is raising money from listenership. I'm sorry, not from listenership, from sponsorship.
Yeah.
An individual doesn't give their money to NPR typically. Typically, they give it to the stations. But all of that, of course, as you're saying, all bets are off now that, you know, what's local. I might be listening. I'm here in Florida right now, and I'm listening to KCRW music because I love it. But so that world is really strange. But what happened in the 70s, to your point, is that was all being created, and nobody really knew exactly how it was going to work out. And when this crisis point happened in the early 80s, because of this overspending, it was natural for the people within NPR, the network, to say, let's go to the listeners. We know the listeners love us. But the problem was that the station's kind of like, well, we love you and we need you too, but we are the ones who go to the listeners to ask them for money. So it's braided together and it's confusing. I think not to suggest that they do it for nefarious means, but it works to their advantage that people really don't know the difference.
Yeah. Here's one of my questions here. Can you talk about the logic there? So like, was there some tortured debate inside the company inside NPR around asking that question? They're broke, because I think this is very important. It essentially is what happened in the blogosphere 20 years later, where they were giving away their content for free. Mm-hmm. Nobody quite yet got to the point where they were just like, hey, like, give, if you like my content, give us money. Some of the infrastructure wasn't necessarily there either. And here's the assumption. People are just too used to listening to stuff with ads. They're never going to pay for it. Obviously, that was totally wrong. Not that advertising supported media isn't important as well. I'm just curious to think about that logic, because it literally is happening again right now. And there's the same level of debates.
Well, and I lived it at the New York Times, which of course is not a nonprofit, but in the late 90s, when I was working on Cyber Times, when the New York Times first went up on the web, everybody was just building their website, if they were smart enough to know that they needed to, and just throwing stuff at it. And I was fortunate enough to back end into this section, Cyber Times, that needed columnists to write for it. And no one who had any print cred wanted to write for the damn web. So people like me back-ended into these jobs, and they had to pay us really well because they needed people who cared and knew and wanted to. And so when we were doing that, the New York Times on the web in the earliest days did charge internationally. I should ask the guys why they did that. For some reason, they thought that people internationally should pay. There was a paywall. And then there wasn't one, if I remember correctly, in the very beginning of the New York Times website. So everybody's always experimenting and trying to see what the viewers will, or listeners or audience will pay for. And, you know, to your point with NPR in the very beginning, they got a little sliver of this Public Broadcasting Act money only because there were a bunch of guys from educational radio stations around the country who said, you're not going to leave. It was a Public Television Act to begin with. You're not going to leave radio out. You have to make this the Public Broadcasting Act. Oh, no. We'll include radio down the road. We've got to get public TV set up first. These guys said, no. You have to put radio in. So they basically scotch taped it into the Public Broadcasting Act, that made it the Public Broadcasting Act, and allocated something like $5 million to create a radio service. And nobody knew what that was. Mm-hmm. All they knew is that there were educational stations around the country that wanted to get some better programming that wasn't just the programming that University of fill in the blank might have from students or professors, people reading books or whatever they did on, you know, classes. They would broadcast popular lecture series. And there was no concentrated media effort. It was just a real playpen. And it was a wonderful playpen if you got your voice on there and you got your message out or your music or whatever. But there was no concentrated strategy. So NPR is set up in 1970, chartered in 1970 to provide on a national level some sort of programming to unify all these stations around the country, and not just unify them, but really basically to up the discourse intelligence of radio, and not just have it be bleeding commercial pop music. So 1970, these guys, mostly guys, were hired, and they came from all over, and they thought about it and they talked about it. And the first thing they did was they create All Things Considered, which went on the air May 3rd, 1971. They didn't even really know what All Things Considered was going to be. They thought, well, 2 hours seems too long, so we'll do it for 90 minutes.
I love how arbitrary everything really is.
Yeah, I mean, the founders even said that. You know, it's kind of like, well, you know, yeah, maybe we can do 90 minutes. An hour's too short. Right. So then they had five reporters. They had a host who lasted a matter of months. You know, they didn't have official job titles, most of them. It was kind of like, oh, you got here today. Why don't you produce? Oh, Linda Wertheimer, who hosted the show for years, started out at the very beginning, and she wound up being the director of the show just because she was organized. And she, you know, hated to see things be disorganized. So that's how unformed it was. And it hadn't occurred to them, oh my God, we got to raise money. Oh my God, what are we going to do when we need to expand? It was only when, I mean, it was gradually, I shouldn't say it's all about Frank Mankiewicz, but as Frank Mankiewicz showed up in the late 70s, he recognized that he needed to fight for more money and think about more creative ways to bring in revenue and to expand the perch. And this is a very long way of saying that there's no simple way to show exactly how this whole public broadcasting finance unfolded. You know, James Ledbetter, I don't know if you ever had him on, he's amazing. He wrote a book about the financing of public broadcasting that's really excellent. It's 20 years old, but it's all about this crossroads that it came to, where it became basically a viable concern. No, it was not a for-profit business where there was stock, but there are people making a lot of money in public broadcasting, even if they don't own stock in the company. We'll get to that too. But so I don't know if that's answering your question, but it was a slow march. And yes. Early on, they decided that it wasn't going to be like the BBC, that they didn't want government involvement, that they didn't want to tax the radios and the televisions to pay for it, that it was going to be an allocation of money that launched it. And then, of course, it has to go from there. It has grown from there.
Well, there's so much there, Lisa. So I want to just tee up two things for you based on what you said, taking whatever order, miss one, pick one, whatever works for you here. So one, can you talk about the implications for the media industry of the idea of your most intense listeners, fans, community really paying? Because what's been interesting is we're going 40 years later, you're seeing even before the pandemic, you have a publication like Vox, which is a for-profit under Vox Media, a company which is trying to either IPO or go probably through a SPAC, actually creating a membership. So this isn't even a nonprofit, it's the same underlying idea. And one of my favorite stories during Up All Night about Ted Turner is back before the CNN days, he actually did a bit of, I mean, he paid people back, but it was sort of a television-based, we need money to keep this station alive idea. Mm-hmm. So the implications of this idea are just very fascinating, both when you're seeing for-profits do it. So that's more of a comment. But the second part is implicit or sort of explicit in everything you're saying is this point that this is this nonprofit activity. There's government, there is the local, and it's about balancing between those things. But there's this really intensive debate around whether news as a whole is something that can even be done in a for-profit manner. So if you're looking at local news right now, you're seeing this huge problem where if you're, for example, I'm from Oregon, my local hometown paper, that is a paper that used to have a total monopoly. If you wanted to get the news, you had to subscribe to the Lake Oswego Review. However, today you just go online and that's available for free, honestly, probably with better coverage. And if anything, that local paper probably just re-aggregates national news and gives it to you that way with some classifieds attached. So can you just speak broadly about the whole public fundraising idea today, but then two, whether or not news is even something that can be done from a, you know, for-profit perspective? Because the one thing I'll just add is that there are actually a bunch of states which are saying, hey, like maybe the government should subsidize local news heavily. There's a lot going on there.
Yeah. Wow. And if we could answer that question, we should just all go do it, right? Like, let's go buy the LA Times, the Tribune papers, take them all public. I love how everybody thinks it's, oh, I'm a rich person. I'm going to buy the Tribune company and take them all nonprofit and, right, you know, local. Good luck. Great. Go. I'll come work for you. But yeah. No, but, you know, you said something that really resonated for me. And that is when you were talking about Vox and just the whole Substack subscriber model. Everybody wants community, right? Community. I mean, we've always wanted community, duh. But now we call it this is your, I'm part of your community. Thank you for welcoming me into your community. And that probably did emanate in some form or fashion from the NPR sense. You know, people date, you know, I'm putting your dating profiles, or doesn't NPR, I think some NPR stations,
oh, yeah,
you, singles nights for 20s or 30s and 40, you know, like however old you are, you go to, it's a religion to people in a different way than, you know, David Muir. I'm sure there are a lot of people who think David Muir is really foxy, but they, you know, it's not like they're sending yeah. money.
Our millennial audience is like, who the hell are you talking about?
I know, sorry.
David Muir, nightly news, ABC, your parents watch him during Christmas break.
Yeah. My mother watches him. I never had seen him. He's very cute. I can see why all the, you know, all the ladies think he's adorable and gay men. I mean, like, he's really great. But no, the whole idea that you feel this ownership of media, not just that you're like my mother sitting in the living room watching the nightly news at the end of the day, which is so quaint and retro, but that you feel you, there was this big controversy earlier this year. They made an NPR AF shirt. Somebody I know who's older said to me, who actually was involved in the early days of NPR, he said to me, what does that mean? And I had to think about it for a second. And I thought, it's not autofocus. Oh yes. My God. Oh my God. And when I told him, he was understandably offended, not to sound like really square, which right. sounds square in itself, but anyway, people are so rabid, you know, tattoos for NPR. They love it.
Tote and I bags. Think that
tote bags,
those
certainly
are everywhere.
Tote bags,
right.
mugs. But I think that people are so starved for ways to belong. And this is aside from the pandemic, and to show, you know, it is a political statement in a way, not even if it's political, that you say, I'm a fan of whatever by wearing a sweatshirt from your hometown, or, you know, it's a way of identifying. And NPR, even back in the 70s, before millions and millions of people listened to it, had started that. And that's why you can thank mostly, I mean, all the women, but Susan Stamberg in particular, because she was the host, the first female host of a national nightly news broadcast. And even though she didn't want to think of it as news, because she wasn't a hard news person the way Nina, Cokie, and Linda were. In fact, she was decidedly anti that kind of inside, what we now call inside the Beltway kinds of news. She wanted, her famous example was when Jimmy Carter got elected, she didn't want to talk to Jimmy Carter. She wanted to talk to his dentist about his teeth because his smile was so famous. And what could she learn about him by talking to his dentist, which is very smart because, you know, he had lots to say about that. But she wound up interviewing Jimmy Carter, by the way. But that's another story. But so I think that NPR didn't set out, and it's like when I had this conversation in the early days of the .com era, the guys who set out in their garage to make the next thing that you set out to do in your garage that made you really rich usually didn't succeed. But the people who came up with an idea because they were really passionate about it and authentically, we never use that word then, but really passionate about it, they were the people who often succeeded. And that's what happened with NPR. They decided not to sound screechy and broadcasting, which is what broadcasting was at that point. And they allowed people in who weren't just white men. And they particularly allowed in women. They didn't allow in tons of people of color, but that's a problem that continues to this day. And that's a whole other issue. But they opened the doors in a way that other broadcasters hadn't done, both by the tone of the stories, the types of stories, and the people who presented those stories. And in so doing, especially since most of their audience in the very beginning wasn't in the big media cities on the coasts. It was in the heartland, and the heartland didn't have a great local newspaper necessarily. Mm-hmm. And so all of a sudden, you know, you're hearing this warm voice bring the news to you in a really humane way. And that made people really fall in love with it. And as a consequence, they, meaning the stations, could raise money based on the fact that people really felt this ownership of this organization. Now, of course, it helps because this concept of nonprofit makes you think, oh, well, they're hard up. You know, I'm not going to give money to a rich person. I'm not going to give money to the ABC with David Muir, who's probably making however many millions of dollars a year, but I'll give money to NPR because they need my support. Well, again, people don't realize they're not giving money directly to NPR. And now, today, they don't realize that many people in NPR in the public radio sphere are making serious money. They're not, you know, not poorly paid. So, but I feel like I lost one part of your question. I'm sorry.
Well, no, I just want to call off a quick comment and I'll throw this to Sagar because I want to highlight something you just said about the nature of these passion projects in media versus the very, we're going to go out and build XYZ media empire bit. Because if you're looking at just the carcasses of media companies that just really failed on the internet, especially the past 10 years. So people who went out and said, you know what, I'm going to use Facebook to build CNN for millennials, or I'm going to do this or this for that. It's funny, something that Sagar and I missed out on is, for example, when Vice News used to be this cool thing back in the late 90s and 2000s, when obviously Vice was out of control in a bunch of different, very specific ways, but it really used to be this gritty, edgy, late 90s, like Lad magazine, which actually had a real audience, had a real people there. And then you see this transition to, hey, like, we're going to turn this into a $5 billion company. Shane Smith gets his awesome, you know, Lambo and the mansion in LA. So that changes this. So I just want to call out just the real need, especially as media refocuses on smaller audiences and telling specific stories cheaper, like a podcast or something like that. That's just a really important thing. But I want to throw this to you, Sagar.
Yeah, Lisa, there's this thing I'm thinking about that emotional connection that you have, you know, obviously with the founding mothers of NPR. I think of like my dad and Planet Money. I mean, he loves Planet Money. Or like Diane Rehm and books. These are like characters in my head. Again, I would never, you know, I've never met them. I probably never will. But they exist for me in a very visceral space. Mm-hmm. I'm curious whether you think that can even happen again today. And Marshall and I were talking about this in the context of like Oprah, where you do actually need somebody who is just this general purpose interviewer who everybody really likes. But it's very telling that it's still Oprah in 2021. It was Oprah in like 1975.
25 years.
And it hasn't changed. And I'm like, is it possible to be Oprah today? Like, and what are we losing by losing that? Because look, there's a lot of benefits to losing that, actually, in terms of corporate control, etc. You know, I am frankly been one of a huge beneficiary of that. That being said, there's something really nice about having this like uniting cultural figure who is universally like beloved. We were talking about this in the context of the royal interview. Now, you could say it's trash or not, but like 100 million people watched it. Okay, like that just doesn't happen anymore. And so from that perspective, I'm just curious from your thoughts. I just teed up a lot to you.
Well, one quick thing, Lisa, because I want to give context for the audience, because this is actually a really interesting debate. So I was listening to a podcast actually that Eric Torenberg did. Listeners will remember him from January. And he was talking with a venture capitalist who said, we are never going to see Oprah's ever again. This is a VC who invests in media. And he's like, look at the big YouTubers. No one's ever heard of most of these people. Look at most, Joe Rogan's obviously very big, but most people don't actually listen to Joe Rogan in the way that you're seeing the Walter Cronkites or the Nina Totenbergs or the anchors at CNN in the 80s and 90s. No one actually has these mass audiences anymore. So what Sagar and I were debating was, A, what function does that mass audience figure serve? And in the current media dynamic, is that something that's ever going to exist again?
You know, it is so interesting because I do remember all of that. You know, the whole idea that there was a big event by Sunday night movie, you know, a movie, The Wizard of Oz, and everybody was watching it. The whole nation watched it. I think we definitely are atomized in a way more than ever before because of that. You know, when I first started working in journalism, the big debate was, is news what you want to know, or what the consumer wants to know, or what they need to know? And what is it that they need to know? There was a big, it's kind of funny and quaint right now, but the big conversation was, well, you know, most Americans don't care about international news. And that's probably true in most countries, that most people really just, they need, most people aren't news junkies like you guys are and aware of what's going on in the world. Your listeners are, but most average people, whatever that means, that's not their thing. And so the question was, how much foreign news or international news, as Ted Turner rightly started to call it, do you give people if that's not of interest to them? And so now, of course, I could very easily just listen to hockey, everything, all day, every day, if that was my thing, and to the exclusion of what's going on. I mean, there are neighbors here in my mother's neighborhood, nice, you know, middle-class neighborhood. People have good jobs. They don't know what the heck's going on in the immediate world around them, much less, you know, much less the much bigger world around them. So I think we lose something because of that atomized media, because you do have a choice of time and venue. And, you know, Oprah is a singular force. How anybody could come along who equals Oprah in any sense is so unimaginable. And yet, you know, who knows? Maybe, yes, I understand what you were saying, that there's no, the infrastructure doesn't allow for there to be that singular voice the way it was when it was a triopoly, or even in the last, you know, before the last 15, 20 years. But I'm always loath to say that there isn't. I think, you know, we definitely lose something as a people if we're not united by that global village that McLuhan talked about. I guess we technically are, in the sense that if we choose to be, we can tune into it. But that again, it erases the whole idea of everyone around me is tuned into the same media.
Yeah.
So
yeah. I want to hit something real quick, which is, I want to get meta for a second. Let's just talk about audio and what audio is, because audio, especially in Sagar and my side of the East Coast of things, is newly just really a priority for a lot of folks. So if it's 2015, 2016, before the pivot to video failed in media, which is basically Facebook and a bunch of online publishers and platforms encouraged publications to spend a lot of money on their video capacity, so people will remember Now This or Mike, lots of video on your Facebook feed. That all basically doesn't work. A lot of publications shut down. So that doesn't really happen as much. That then has led to publications really focusing on audio as a format. This is why you see everyone launching a podcast and spending less money and time on video. That's why you're seeing apps like Clubhouse or the Twitter Spaces alternative cup. And so NPR, if anything, from the start, is the story of audio. So can you just speak about what audio means? Because given everything we're talking about, it's just funny that 40, 50 years later, we're still in the audio space. The whole point of the 80s and cable TV, the whole point of you going to the New York Times and MSNBC, I don't think we go back to the dot-com bubble version of you and tell you that there's this huge, intense interest in audio that I think you'd be surprised to hear that. So I'd love to just hear your general thoughts there.
Well, you know, Susan Stamberg herself says that radio has the best pictures. You know, it's a beautiful medium. It's an evocative medium. It's an easier medium, clearly, obviously, to produce than television, cheaper, and you can do great stuff. And back to the whole community thing, that's why you have a listenership. People like to hear it, to be part of a community, and it's easier to invite people into that community than when it's got to be a slickly produced television show. You know, television, pretty much by definition, although I do love watching C-SPAN and it's been very immensely helpful to me in the last two books I've written, you know, television has to be produced, and that's a different sort of sensibility. So I think that we're seeing this, or we've been seeing this attraction to radio or audio storytelling, because it is such a beautiful, evocative. It doesn't have to always be simple. Yes, there are really skilled people who are producing rich layered, what do they call it? Sound rich storytelling. But even without the sound rich storytelling, it transports you and takes you somewhere. I've recently started listening to audiobooks in a way that I never had before.
Us. Yeah, we're audiobook fiends over
here. We're fishing for that Audible sponsorship here.
Yeah. Please sponsor us, Audible. Yeah.
Excellent. Excellent. And everybody should listen to me read my books. All
you read the book?
I've read them all.
I forget. Yeah. I listened to a quick thing on this. I listened to Up All Night. Did you read Up All Night?
Oh, wow. You mean my book?
Yeah, that's how I did Up On. I did Up On.
Yes, I did read it. Yes,
okay,
yes,
great.
I read
it. Okay, it was good. Yes.
Good. Okay, good. Yeah, that's what we want. But I know some people like books that are read by the author and all. Yeah.
I think it's important.
Especially if it's nonfiction. I think it makes a big difference. But yes, so I think that audio is seeing a resurgence. And of course, the other funny, haha, ironic thing is that audio never used to be so simple. I mean, it was certainly simpler than television, but if you look at what it used to look like and having to splice it and people splicing their fingers and the blood coming all over the tape and all of that, it's now, here I am with my little $40 microphone.
Yeah, look at these.
And, right? Yeah. And we're thanks to this broadband, we're all connected. So it just makes sense. I mean, of course, the mythology is that you do it and you get rich, but at least you're able to open up. I produce this and host this, co-produce and co-host this podcast with biographers where we interview biographers every week. And it's not like we'd ever expect anybody's going to pay us for it. It's a volunteer project. It's a labor of love. But it's a great way to reach people in the biography community. So why not do it? Why not try it? But yeah, I think you definitely can thank this love that people have of NPR and the really particular brand of storytelling for that, for sure.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Well, I mean, it's just the way you viscerally feel something with audio, there's nothing else like it. Right. I don't know why. It's like Sarah Koenig's voice. When I hear her voice, she's the Serial host for right. People's. And she's just incredible. Like, she's got this like soothing tone. I could listen to that woman tell any story about anything. But I'm curious because I know the paperback of Up All Night, speaking of which, is coming out. And it came out right at the beginning of the pandemic. There's an entire other podcast to be had about literally like cable post-Trump. But I'm curious for your perspective of cable during the pandemic and now post-Trump, where there's a lot to be made around lack of ratings. Some of it probably was going to happen anyway as a natural contraction from the election. But there is a natural thing going on here about some people having a real hard time finding other stuff to cover. Big open-ended question. I'm curious for your perspective.
It drives me crazy that people say there isn't enough stuff to cover. It's lazy, really, because there's plenty of stuff to cover. The obvious is off the stage for now, but and maybe forever, let's hope. But it goes to why that whole idea of pack journalism and DC journalism just is not my cup of tea, because really there is so much happening in our world that could be covered more widely. Now but it's not easy. And it's really not easy to do if you are on a short staff with a tight budget and a quick deadline. I mean, the good digging is it needs to be done, and it's hard to do, and not everybody's inclined to do it. And it doesn't necessarily get your face on the air and the bucks. So that's a big issue. But it's so interesting to have written this book and have it come out when it did. And having read a lot about Murdoch after I wrote the book, I was preparing to be interviewed for an upcoming documentary that I think is supposed to air on CNN, ironically, about Murdoch.
Right. Yeah.
And reading more about him than I ever had before, especially to look at him teeing up him against Turner, which I decidedly did not do in the book, probably that was dumb for the sales perspective, because everybody wants that fight. But I wanted that origin story, and he wasn't there yet. But basically, Murdoch says TV news is entertainment, and that's it. It's entertainment. It, back to an earlier question. I can't remember which one of you guys talked about it, but the whole idea that nonprofit news would make it pure. It's not going to make it pure. You still have to find an audience. You still have to, I mean, I guess I should never say it's not going to make it pure, but the whole mythology that, you know, if there was a government controlled television service, that it would be more sober, right, somber and deliberate and fair and whatever. I don't think that that's possible. Yeah,
it's like, have you heard of Russia? Like, you know, right. It's like, you know, like I actually, at a point in my life, had to watch some Russian state TV. They know exactly what people click on, don't click on, etc. And whenever it comes to subliminal messaging, it's almost like advertising. Like what they're doing is they're hooking you on to the stuff that you want. And then they'll just insert like, by the way, Putin is really awesome. You know, it's like that's how they do their ads in terms of that. I love that you're reading about murder. I read an entire biography of him. I'm curious if you read it. The Michael Wolff one, which is written in a very strange way because Wolff is his own like character, but he actually spent a lot of time with Murdoch. So I'm curious. I want to get some of your reflections on that.
Interesting. I did not read that one. You know what I did? I went back and looked at the newspapers, the source of probably, well, he did original reporting, but I was looking at the newspaper coverage of basically when Fox came on the scene, MSNBC yep. came on the scene, and mm-hmm. what happened in that, you know, in the immediate aftermath to CNN, which had been the only 24-hour news channel in town at that point. And then I was trying to research their kind of ongoing feud. And they, you know, Ted Turner, I think, was annoyed that Murdoch swooped in and stole his thunder by, you know, basically touching all kinds of media that he'd been touching, you know, and had this swagger before he arrived. So I spent more time looking at that than anything, just because it was so interesting to see how it was drawn out, you know, the whole AOL Time Warner debacle, and Ted exiting the stage. And really, you know, that's why it really is unfair to pit them against each other, even though they were quote unquote rivals. Ted Turner had nothing to do with CNN by the time that, I mean, he never had anything to do operationally day to day with CNN, the way Murdoch sort of pulled the strings
yes.
on Fox. It wasn't, they're not equal. It's like, it just wasn't a fair.
It's a good point. Quality, yeah. Because, so. You know, he's so involved in the publication of his papers to the point where, I mean, I'm basing off the Michael Wolff thing. Wolff spent hours with him. Actually, like he'll literally send, like he reads all of his papers in the morning and he even edits like the headlines. It's completely right. crazy.
Right.
Marshall, do you have something you wanted to add?
Well, yeah. Well, and this yeah. is, Lisa, I love this because there's a very small but concentrated group of like Ted Turner people who were just, who I personally feel that tragedy isn't the right word, but it actually is. A variety of, like, basically everything is AOL Time Warner's fault, that you had this person who basically built so much of our, not just built, but willed into existence in good ways and bad ways, a lot of our modern world, mm-hmm. who just people just don't really know about. I think the difference between Murdoch and Turner is that what Turner does is that Turner builds a model. So Turner, through his Ted Turneriness, to use proper English, gets the first commercial satellite to actually like you to up to gets that process going so that CNN could actually go when that did not seem possible, when it's easy to see most other people would have given up. Ted Turner is the person who is going from taking over his father's billboard company in the South and then buying the Atlanta Braves and then spread that. I think that is just something, once again, this isn't to besmirch anything Murdoch's done in this context, but it's just to say these are just two fundamentally different business innovations and things that they do. You know, yes. Murdoch is an Australian newspaper magnate. They're just totally different.
Right. At his core, Murdoch was a journalist. I mean, from the get-go. Mm-hmm. And at his core, Ted Turner was a businessman, which is why it's ironic that it's Murdoch who said that news is a business. And Ted, you know, espoused this view that news was pure, but he was not the news guy ever. And he was never the day-to-day operational guy. So it really, it is that, that's why their stories are interesting. There is a book, I can't even remember what it's called. It's from 20 years ago, Murdoch versus Turner.
Oh, it's Clash of the Titans. Yeah.
Yeah.
It has a terrible cover.
Everyone wants to look at it. It's
It's I just, I know this, I'd sear it forever.
Look this thing up.
Sagar, this is one of the worst covers for ever. A book. Yeah, ever.
Ever. It's like a, it's like a bad comic book or something. Yeah.
This is horrible.
Yeah, it was interesting to read it. You know, it's very dramatic, and it pulls from a lot of the media coverage of the time, which was very dramatic. I think, you know, Ted was saying he was going to slug Murdoch, and you know, there was it was good bombastry, but that's the irony, is that Ted seems like he was Mr. Pure Journalism when he in fact was not, and Murdoch really was, but he basically, in the end of the day, when it came to television, it was business, Fox, and you know, we know what that left us. Right. So yeah, it's, but anyway, that's a whole other interesting story. I wonder if Rupert Murdoch ever listens to NPR.
You know, it wouldn't surprise me, actually.
Yeah, it would.
I'm curious. I remember last time you told us this story, how you were like, you were the first online correspondent for MSNBC, because you told us, you said something interesting where you were like, you know, people talk about in terms of how it was inevitable here, but it also is a discrete choice the way the cable did become this way. It probably was always destined for this, just in terms of the medium. I'm a firm believer in that. That being said, you are literally there from the very beginning. When you guys were there on the ground floor of MSNBC, like, did you think this was going to, like, at what point did you realize things were going to go the way they did with cable news?
Well, see, now I joined MSNBC from the New York Times, and I replaced a woman named Mary Kathleen Flynn. So she had technically done the job I did as internet. There was one person, internet correspondent, and she was it, and then I replaced her. So I came in a couple of years in, 3 years into its existence. So by the time I got there, the real conversation was about this MSNBC. There were two separate companies. The website was run by MS, Microsoft, and the TV was NBC. And then United, they had these two properties, which, you know, had the usual problems that you have when you have people from two different industries running two different properties that have the same name, but are supposed to be, you know, united. And the big conversation then was, when is the web going to be capable of doing what we all do now on the phone, which is watch entire movies? So that was, we were preparing for that and playing around with Real Player. I don't even know if you remember that.
Oh, I remember Real Player.
The key thing for us, Lisa, is that we are just old enough to remember the tail end of basically all these references.
Yeah. Oh, well, God.
You respect history, so you know about them. Yeah. You weren't there, right? So with MSNBC, nobody. I do remember that when colleagues left to go to Fox, and when I was downsized in this mass downsizing in 2001 before 9/11 happened, they had a cut 10%
from the bubble, I guess, from the dot com bubble.
It was really more that GE, which owned NBC at that point, there was an edict that every property across GE's fleet of companies had to cut 10%. And they cut the internet correspondent, probably a commentary on me as much as about the job itself. But I always thought that was ironic, since the whole thing about MSNBC was that it was the, you know, Fox was doing its thing. CNN was still this plain Jane news in a plain, plain brown wrapper sounds illicit, but you know, news without the frills, news with the star. And then MSNBC was supposed to be the rockin' experimental with the technology. It was supposed to unite this new internet thing that was just making its way. And so, you know, they had this big layoff in 2001. And where was I going with that? But we were, and I was the person who was writing for the web, even though I was paid by MSNBC, I was writing for the web 3 times a week. And that, like, by the way, every single person in media does everything now, right? They write for the web, they have a podcast, they have a, but I was this sort of experiment who was writing and speaking on the air. And we even experimented with something that today would be a podcast. But we were playing around with the technology. And basically, a couple of years in, when there was the financial crunch, nobody cared. And that was when nobody cared about continuing that experimentation. Mm-hmm. And that was when it kind of took a turn. I shouldn't say took a left turn. It took a turn to become more pure news. Mm-hmm. Let's forget this experimental, you know, if we could look up, like, Soledad O'Brien was an anchor there in the very beginning. And she was sort of the poster person for this new high-tech, highfalutin web mm-hmm. United cable thing. And that was so exciting. But it really did pretty quickly go by the wayside and become Fox, MSNBC, CNN. And that's when CNN had to really start amping up its differences or its sexiness. And not just be the news was the star anymore. And that was, you know, there's a whole devolution there because, you know, up until that point, everybody who was in power at CNN believed fully in the news. It's news. It's hardcore mm-hmm. news. News as defined by the 90s, which was as objective as possible. And meanwhile, over there, you've got Fox doing its crazy stuff. Oh, and I was saying, when people left MSNBC, when I was downsized, I thought, oh my God, I hope I don't get a job at Fox because I need a job. But what would I do if I got a job at Fox? Oh my God. And of course I didn't get a job at Fox. I'm not blonde. I was also at that point 38 or whatever I was. But yeah, I was aging out of television at that stage. But we had colleagues who did go over there and I always felt kind of sorry for them. So yeah, at that point, even a few years into MSNBC's existence, it was much more about the three sheep or something. I don't know. I'm happy not to work in TV anymore.
Yeah.
I want to, for my last question, I want to tie all this together and look a bit towards the future just to set things up. One, super conventional wisdom to say this, but obviously I would say our generation, the millennial cohort, are not intensive cable news watchers. And that's not a statement about MSNBC. It's not Fox News. This isn't a political statement. It's just don't subscribe. I subscribed to the cable bundle for just this year for once randomly because it was a good deal. Wanted to watch sports and everything. Gen Z, I know for a fact, is not subscribing to cable. But then it's very easy to say cable is just dying. They don't get these big audiences. But at the same time, it's a brilliant business model. You get a cable bundle. So it's advertising, it's the subscription, all these things. And then at the same time, you're seeing, I like the way you put this actually, how like your initial experiment at MSNBC was really trying to do it all in the ways that the most successful personalities can too. What you can do is you can wake up, you could do a TV hit, you could write an op-ed, you can appear at a live event show. That's very cool right now. You can do a podcast, all these different bits. So you have people like Megyn Kelly, you know, obviously, it doesn't work at NBC. It doesn't work out at Fox, but they then create a podcast. So can you just talk about the future, your just perception of the future of these industries and the way that, to keep teeing you up even further, the way that I've appreciated about your work, which is that you're focusing on the technology that makes this possible, but then also the personalities and then the broader trends in American society, but sort of unifying all of it together.
Well, you know, the personality thing is a really important thing to focus on because people want, you know, they relate to people. They don't relate just to a voiceless or a disembodied voice. So I think that, and I write a little bit about this in this book, this new book about NPR, and the criticism of journalists becoming celebrities, journalists having brands. Because for so long, journalists, most of them, columnists as an exception, were people who were out reporting in the field and coming back doing the stories. And it wasn't about me. It was, you know, maybe you liked my story, but that sort of personality driven news. And maybe that's part of your reason, the answer to your question about Oprah, about why will there not be another Oprah or if there will be another Oprah, is because everybody's trying to be Oprah or Martha Stewart. Everybody wants that, you know, to be, you know, and it's also unfair too, the way we've talked for years about, is it fair that a politician have to be somebody who looks good and sounds really good? If they're a really good administrator, politician, why do they have to be this whole package? And that's what you have to be in journalism now. You have to look a certain way and you have to sound a certain way and be quick on your feet and pithy and live shots and live events, like you say. And so that troubles me. I myself, and this may be because I'm getting older or just tired, or I love reading history. I love reading about how things were depicted at the time that they happened. I love reading nonfiction accounts of things that happened in the past. And I challenge myself not to be consuming day of media with a frenzy the way so much of society does. I subscribed, I think since I last talked to you, I subscribed to The Economist. And I don't even look at the app, is great. And they do all kinds of live programming and all that kind of stuff. But I get it. And the first thing I do is I turn to the back for the obit, which is the best obit ever in The Economist every week. It helps me understand the world in a different way because it is an international publication more than it is, you know, a US centric publication. But I feel utterly unqualified to answer what you're saying, because I, although I wish everybody would do what I'm doing and then I can start a cult and then I can be really famous like Oprah and, you know, no, but I just having watched all of this unfold, and it's been so exciting, especially that web period, that post Netscape IPO period and that time at the New York Times, it was such a thrill. Now it's just kind of like, because I've seen it, I feel like it is all cyclical. And I'm eager to see what you and others cook up next. But I do wish sometimes in this kind of old person's, I'm not that old, but you know, I back retro concept of it was better when you just had the news delivered at one time during the day. Or two times during the day, and in the morning with a morning newspaper. There's just something nice about it. You know, obviously, if you're in the industry, it's different. But I also worry too about this whole notion that because Trump is gone, there's nothing to cover. Maybe the DC press corps, White House press corps, has nothing to cover because Joe Biden is just doing his job. But it just seems like there's so much for us to investigate and understand about the world around us that we're not catching.
Because it came up from what your earlier comment. It's not that there's nothing to cover. It's just that the business model and the format of a specific style of news isn't equipped to cover that thing. And that's why, once again, the conversation about podcasting and newsletters are really exciting, because right now there's some really fascinating Substacks out there. There's a Substack that I can't remember her name, unfortunately, but there's just a professor who does really in-depth US history. And there are people who love that.
Right? She's the top lady too. Nobody ever talks about her. She's literally the top person.
But this is the key thing. Yeah. No one talks about her because, once again, it's not as if the audience here is massive. There just are something, I think, in the low tens of thousands of people that will pay for it. So what I think anyone who's interested in this topic, because people reach out to us asking about journalism a lot, really think about, as you're looking at your career, what format is necessary and best at telling the stories you're trying to tell, which is that if you're trying to go deep, if you're trying, for example, I would hate to do this conversation with you, Lisa, in a 5-minute cable hit. Sagar, what if we brought Lisa on Rising, which is Sagar's YouTube show? That'd be what, 3 minutes?
12. You'd have 12 minutes, yeah.
Totally. Yeah, 12 minutes at best, and it just doesn't work.
Right.
It's not enough. It's, you know, you said you weren't qualified. I think you're 10 times more qualified, because the thing is, and you know this, the people who are in the business are oftentimes the people who know the least amount about what's actually happening in the business, as in like, what is the business of your publication? You may want to find out, because from my perspective, you don't look all that relevant in terms of where things are happening. I do want to, by the way, your articulation there of history is so important. And it's something, when I was a White House correspondent, it killed me about how many people there had no idea about the subjects they were reporting on. My favorite one from this is that they didn't know who Dan Quayle was. The people who were in the White House press corps did not know who the former vice president of the United States not even a couple of years, like a couple of terms ago, who was someone was like, who is Dan Gilbert? And I was like,
ultimate erasure.
Are you literally serious right now? I couldn't believe it. And that's just one of like a million different anecdotes that I could give everybody. And the articulation there about why you need to read history if you're going to try and understand, that is what makes you, I believe, qualified to project the future. The Mark Twain quote is super cliche, but it is true. History doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme. So from that perspective, you are a huge biography nerd like we are. Give us your top 3 to 5 recommendations. We'll create a book list for this that people can go and buy, specifically recommended by Lisa. So go ahead.
Wow. You know, I hope you've read the Walter Isaacson biography of Steve Jobs.
Of course.
Oh, check. That book is amazing. And a lot of people freaked out because it's so fat. It is so important. Good. And it's so important for the younger the people are, the more people should read it. But everybody should read it. It was such an important book. I'm in biography school right now. I just read my first Doris Kearns Goodwin.
Which one?
Oh, which one?
Team of Rivals.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh,
yeah. Yeah. Another big fat one. And it was great. I'm not inclined to read her or that kind of work, but it was really instructive. I didn't know much about Lincoln. I knew he was a great man. I now know he's controversial, but that was a fabulous
book. The reason that book is so important is because Lincoln's greatness wasn't just Emancipation Proclamation. He was actually a phenomenal politician. And that's what people did not understand until they read Team of Rivals.
That I certainly didn't know. And it's been really excellent to read it. You know, we in this class, we read Eminent Victorians.
Oh, yeah. So, of course. Yeah.
Okay. Funny. Yeah, you guys know that.
I'm very, very well read. And
wow. Okay. Wow. You are my favorite people.
For audio listeners, I just pulled out my roommate's copy. It's not mine. Yeah. That's the real confession. It's not mine.
We know what it is. We know what it is.
Okay. That's pretty cool. That book, we spent so much time talking about that book because it does these slice of life mini biographies or short biographies, brief biographies. And they're all based on source material. He didn't know any of them. I mean, I think the best biographies often aren't, because of course that's the kind of book I write. But that's not why I say that. But it really, really is so interesting to see how he drew these four people, only one of whom I knew, Florence Nightingale, and I knew this much. I knew she was a nurse. I didn't know why she was famous. I just knew her name. But yeah, it's a really interesting example of biography. And I really enjoyed it. I like the doorstop books occasionally. We're reading, this week we read Oscar Wilde by Richard Ellman. Not as interesting to me. And next week we're reading Francis Bacon by my professor, Annalyn Swan, and her husband, Mark Stevens. You know, it's hard for me to say best biographies, but without question, the Walter Isaacson is aces. It can be required reading. I mean, it's just
And what I'll just say real quick is, to tie a knot on this, so Steve Jobs, excellent book to understand the world before 2011.
Absolutely.
In the sense that Steve Jobs' death, to the tech side of the show we do, Steve Jobs' death is really just this demarcation line between the optimistic, really positive facing Silicon Valley that you were covering, that was in many ways literally funding the MSNBC that existed through the partnership with Microsoft, and the really contentious, hyper-political one we have today. Team of Rivals, we'll put these in the bookshop link for everyone. Team of Rivals is just, it's a great book, but it's also an interesting look into the world of 2007, 2008, because it is one of those books that was like a fashionable Washington book in the sense that a lot of people in 2008 would say things like, hey, President Obama, you need to have a Team of Rivals. So the argument for bringing Hillary in his autobiography, President Obama says that wasn't why he picked Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State. But there was actually a lot of like talk at the time of he's trying to have this Team of Rivals cabinet. So it's one of those books that really influence perception and language people use. And it's fascinating when someone could write a humongous book. I mean, we're talking about Audible. It's a 40-hour Audible book. So yeah, the fact that you could write that book and that could influence it. And then Eminent Midichlorians, it's a fascinating book because it's really about, it's an indictment of a generation and a specific class of people. It's written, we talked about this with Helen Andrews at the start of this season, but it's a book that's about how Victorian Britons in different categories, whether it's General Gordon and Sudan, so the British Empire, Florence Nightingale, you know, do-gooderism, the Anglican Church, all these different facets of British Victorian society, how could these amazing people build the world that led to World War One? And it's really written like in that context. So it's fascinating. So it's not quite as fashionable as the other two, but a huge recommendation.
I've got one more for you too. It just, please, when you were saying that,
hit us.
The new Eleanor Roosevelt biography by David Michaelis.
Oh, I haven't read it. I heard good things. I know.
What's the name again?
It's Eleanor. It's,
oh, it's very straightforward.
Yeah.
It's apparently the only single volume biography of Eleanor's whole life. And it is, you know, it's one of those, it does what biography does best. It's about Eleanor, but it's about the time in which she lived. And her story alone, I didn't know the backstory, is so dramatic and tragic. And then, you know, enter, that's even before she married Franklin. And then their lives together. It's an exceptional work, as is all of his work. But that's a really good one.
It's funny. Some of those early American aristocrats were like more globalist in a way than like many current. Like, she was raised in the UK, you know. It's like, or like, I remember reading about Teddy Roosevelt and he's like gallivanting in the Holland and like living with his like Dutch
Egypt in the Middle East, yeah, like, learning German, like, of a German family.
I'm like, I don't even get to do this, you know. Like, I'm like, what is going on here? I should have been born as an early aristocrat. Okay, we could probably literally talk about this for hours. We should bring you back just to do an entire book show. Lisa, thank you so much for joining us. We are going to be, we'll have a link to your book in the show notes on our bookshop, as well as all of your other recommendations. Is there anything else for people to find you?
LisaNapoli.com.
There we go.
Oh, wait, yeah. there is one final question. Lisa, what's the next book?
Oh yeah, right.
So I'm thinking, I'm not exactly sure yet, but I recently found out about an exchange program at a women's college in the 60s that sent that brought Black women to the Wellesley College campus to go to school for a year. And I'm really interested in what happened to the women who came there. It went on for about 6 or 8 years, but I'm not sure I'm going to write a book about that yet. But isn't that interesting to think that in the 60s, in upper crust New England, a rich school brought the women in from schools down south. They took the junior year and they spent the year there. It just sounds like a movie. Like, what happened? How did they all get along, right, and how it all came about? But I'm really kind of taking a break right now because I'm not really sure. That's
fair. Can I make a plea though for one thing?
Row. Yes.
Can I make a plea for one thing? So I was looking for a good biography of Sam Walton and it doesn't exist. So I don't know anything about Sam Walton. He died when I was a baby, literally.
Walmart, like founder of Walmart.
Of course, you know, I thought that there was one. I know that his daughter intrigued me because after I wrote the Joan Crock book, I was looking at Alice, but I didn't know that there wasn't one about
him. He's written an autobiography. There are a couple but there's no definitive bio of Sam Walton. And I'm reading this dude's biography right now. First of all, kind of hilarious, because it was written in 1992 with very different cultural norms, I'll just say, in terms of some of the language that he uses. But really interesting figure. I was reading a biography of Bezos, and Bezos was obsessed with Sam Walton. So I was like, oh, well, I should go read a biography of Sam Walton. And I could not find a good one. And given how many awesome ones you've done, I'm like, Lisa needs to do this. So
you're so
I've now confronted you on the air.
Well, that's good. No, I'm glad you did. And I wonder if would you read a book about the New York Times, Cyber Times, and the web?
Oh, hell
Okay.
Lisa, I would also read it.
Let's pitch you on air for this. The reason why there is just a segment. No, I'm going to put it a better way. We keep on going, so just stop. I know you have like commitments, so just stop.
I've got two in a little while. No, I'm good.
Okay.
So everything in our society today is fundamentally about the New York Times. Let's just run down the list. I have this revved up because I'm obsessed with it. One, debates about whether institutions work and whether they don't work. So for example, there's this massive fight, not massive, but if you go on parts of Twitter, which, you know, in our private conversations, you've referred to as toxic. So that's very much a true thing. But if you actually look at the New York Times' success, it's this fascinating story because it says something about, hey, like actually big centralized media institutions can be incredibly successful. The New York Times, like the battle y'all were waging in the 1990s to take it online, the debate around whether or not content is free or not, the debate around individual choices, the story of where the Times now ended up with deciding, hey, like, what's that if we just charge people? It's centralization versus decentralization. It's personalities versus not. There's and this is the other thing too. So much of what the New York Times is now doing today is it's bringing together all of these personalities. People call it the New York Yankees of newspapers now. So I think, you know, to compliment your work some more, what you do so well is just focus on these personalities. And it's just, I don't know, like for example, like Scott Galloway was on the board of the New York Times during the 2000s, during the period when the New York Times was not particularly successful, when Carlos Slim is coming in. So there's all these random things. There's so many stories about the fate of the press, the state of discourse, business, everything you could hit there. It's so much more than the failing New York Times Trump era debate that people sort of get caught up in.
Right.
No,
right.
If you did a cyber, the beginning of like where you were, and then like Iraq, Bill Keller era, I'm really going deep here. But
wow,
like,
you're good. I'm impressed. Yeah,
so you've got like Keller, and then, you know, there was like this fallout. Like 06 is like this weird thing where like everybody's like, the New York Times is dead. What are they going to do? The stock price is through the floor. Don't know if they should go all in subscriptions. Then they do go all in subscriptions. Now they're literally the most successful media company on earth, in addition to being like they've got like their show on like FX or whatever. Yeah. They're one of the most popular podcasts in the country. Their podcast franchising is building out. They're essentially a talent agency for a specific brand. In addition to being dramatically successful, you got a lot there. I would read the hell out of that book.
Of course, you know, what I'll do is the 5 years that I worked there, whatever it was, and focus on a very torrid period of my life. But that won't be as interesting in the bigger sense.
That would be good. I would read it. Yeah.
You sold two copies. If you can take that to your agent, you've got two pre-orders.
There's enough people who are listening to this podcast who will buy it. Okay. All right, Lisa.
Yeah, really, thank you so much, Lisa.
Thank you.
You guys are great. Thank you so much. I can't thank you. What a perfect way to launch the book. Thank you.
Yeah, awesome.
Okay, bye.
Thanks for listening to the episode, guys. Really appreciate it. As always, if you enjoyed that book back and forth, go ahead and check out our bookshop.org link there in the bio, as well as the show notes. It will really help you out in terms of finding any of the things that we recommend here. As always, also give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Really helps other people find the show. Special shout out to the Lincoln Network for sponsoring this podcast. We really appreciate the work that they let us do here, and we will see you all on Thursday.